Hi, Patrick Cox here in the World Newsroom in Boston, and this is the World in Words number 32. How rotten is your English? Rotten enough perhaps to warrant a new translation of the Bible.
It takes you from where you are and it places you there. The bishop, after I read the passage, said, "I was there." That's what happens when you hear the scriptures in Patois.
Rotten scripture, rotten music, rotten literature. That's today's podcast.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
Don't let me miss the open door. Show me where the open door is. And even if it's cracked up a little bit, man, maybe I'll plow right on through that.
Як шамаш? Thank you, Borat. You're pretty rotten yourself. The World is co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. You can hear the big show on more than 250 public radio stations around the United States. For more on that, for more on all of our podcasts, go to theworld.org. For more on this podcast, and to post your comments, go to the Facebook group, The World in Words. This week, part two of our look at the English language. Last week, it was dead English dudes, dead but inventive, Shakespeare, Milton, Orwell. This week, we enter the land of the living. We're going to travel to some of the outer reaches of the English language, places where English has mixed it up with some local tongues. First, the newest translation of the Bible, Jamaican Patois, causing quite a stir. Then we'll hear from writers like Muda Baruka, Linton Kwesi Johnson, and we'll hear from the editor of a collection of so-called rotten English writing. First, the Bible. Now, for a long time, groups such as the Bible Society have made it a central goal to translate the New Testament into as many languages as they can. And we're not just talking about big languages here. We're talking about fairly small minority languages, much smaller than Scottish Gaelic and Welsh, which you'll hear mentioned in the following report. The Bible has been translated in full or in part into, well, I've seen the stat of 4,000 languages. I don't know how accurate that is. So here's the story. It's reported out of London by the BBC's Robert Piggott.
How a man fi ban when him whole already? For sure.
St. John's Gospel, as you've probably never heard it before. Jesus tells Nicodemus in Patois that to enter heaven, he must be born again.
Rabbi, we know say you are one teacher what come from God.
There are 5 million speakers of Patois, many in Britain. The Reverend Courtney Stewart, who's leading the 12-year translation project, says expat Jamaicans were reduced to tears on hearing the Patois Bible.
It has a transporting influence about it. It takes you from where you are and it places you there. On Sunday, we were at a church in London here, essentially comprised of Jamaicans and West Indians. And the bishop, after I read the passage, said, "I was there." That's what happens when you hear the scriptures in Patois.
Patois evolved from slavery to be spoken by the poor. Now it's used in middle-class households, but this is virtually the first time it's been put down on paper. Scots Gaelic got its biblical translation 250 years ago. The lilting, soulful singing of Gaelic psalms echoes from chapels in Scotland every Sunday. Professor Donald Meek, who recently helped modernise the translation, says the Bible reinforced a language short on literature and disparaged by the literary elite, just as the Welsh Bible helped keep that language alive.
The translation of a document like the Bible into a language like Scottish Gaelic gives the language a serious place in people's minds. There is an elevation of the status of language. It establishes a literary benchmark.
There are versions of the Bible for Cockneys, Scousers, Australians, and those living in the deep south of the United States. Some traditionalists claim that such translations dilute and distort the message. Courtney Stewart rejects the idea. He says hearing the Good Samaritan in Patois brings its message home as English could not.
Then Jesus asks the expert in the law, say, "Out of the three of them, who you think did a neighbour to the man where the thief them beat up?" The expert in the law, say, "The one will take care of him." Jesus, say, "Go do the same thing."
The Reverend Courtney Stewart of the Bible Society of the West Indies. Here he is on the roots of Jamaican patois.
Patois began during the period of slavery, when the various tribes would be taken from Africa to the West Indies, and in particular to Jamaica. They were split up in a number of ethnic groups so as to minimize the threat of rebellion. Now, out of this clash of cultures, if you like, a language developed, because naturally they could not communicate with each other because they came from very different ethnic tribes. And the one dominant language was the language of the plantation owner, English. So it is an English-based Creole, similar like in Haiti. Their Creole is a French-based Creole, and similar to the Dutch Caribbean, where it is a Dutch-based Creole.
What I don't have here is anyone opposing the establishment of this new Bible. But rest assured, there are many, many opponents. Jamaicans who believe that they should read and study the Bible in English. They generally regard English as a language and Jamaican Creole or Patois as something less than a language, a slang. But for the Reverend Stewart, that slang is the language of the people.
There are 2.7 million Jamaicans in the island of Jamaica, and it is estimated that there's that number in the Jamaican diaspora. All of us understand it. Now, there are a few of us who would claim we don't speak it. However, the vast, overwhelming majority of us understand it, and a vast number of us speak it. And for many of us, they don't speak it by choice. This is what they speak. This is our language.
That kind of impassioned claim is really sort of a reclaim, and it's an effort to reclaim homegrown culture and language. Enough already with the tongue of the colonizer, or at least let the imported language and the homegrown language coexist. Now, Creoles have been called, on more than one occasion, bastard tongues. That's what Derek Bickerton called them. You can check out an interview with him in The World in Words, number 2. Creoles, or broken-up versions of English, have also been called rotten English. That term was coined in 1985 by Nigerian writer Ken Sarawiwa. He published a novel, and he called it Soza Boy, a novel in rotten English. So what is rotten English? Well, it's not the Queen's English. It's a local English, a vernacular. It's a transcription of English as it is spoken in a particular place, a long way away from Buckingham Palace or Stratford-upon-Avon or Washington, D.C. I think I can say that I first came across rotten English when I started listening to British punk music. You know, people like Johnny Rotten and Sid Vicious, and especially Joe Strummer. Love that stuff. You gotta remember, the punks in those days in the late 70s were reacting to all of those British pop stars who would sing with fake American accents and use American English vocabulary. And they'd even sing about, you know, California sunsets or something. It just simply didn't relate to their immediate surroundings. And then all of a sudden, there was this style, this punk style that just sounded genuine and familiar and real. And then the next thing that happened was that punk ushered in reggae. And reggae really only existed, in Britain at least, as a Jamaican underground scene. And then you had these punk stars introducing white Britain to people like Linton Kwesi Johnson.
Everywhere you go, it's the talk of the day. Everywhere you go, you hear people say that the special patrol, them a murderer. Murderer, we can't make them get no further.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is rotten English. Now, someone who's studied the written version of this non-standard English is Dora Ahmad. She teaches post-colonial literature at St. John's University in New York. She's edited a fantastic anthology called Rotten English, which is available in paperback. As she told me, she included pieces of writing from around the English-speaking world.
And that's what I loved about putting this anthology together, that suddenly all of these connections across Anglophone world literature became obvious when I put them all together, that whether it was for class reasons or reasons of colonialism or reasons of race within one place, that there were a lot of writers who were alienated from the standard form and who took it upon themselves to both codify and really at the same time also create a new language.
Is Rotten English new?
Oh, absolutely not. I would start with Chaucer and Shakespeare. There have always been people who seemed revolutionary at the time and later on became what we now think of as canonical. So,
how does that work? Take us through the process.
The move at the time is to write in a language that is not literary, that is primarily oral, which then becomes popular. It was something that happened very strongly during the early modern period because it combined with print technology. So I think the cliche about Shakespeare is that he invented all of these words. You look back at the Oxford English Dictionary and he provides the first example of so many specific words. And I think a kind of cliched understanding of what he did is that he's this poetic and literary genius who simply pulled these things out of thin air, when in fact he had the luck to be writing at the same time. His work provided some of the first written examples of these words. So it's this combination of economic changes and changes in media technology combined with what I really would say are these specific artistic and literary geniuses, but not working in a vacuum on their own. So it's just this combination of circumstances that happens at different periods. What's so interesting about what's happening now is even in the time since I put the collection together, we have a non-standard form that's much more written than oral. So most of the examples that I would say that I have been looking at from the 15th century to the present are oral forms that then become written. But now with texting, we have a non-standard written form. So that's something that's a new shift, even after I put Rotten English together, which was just 2 or 3 years ago.
Right. And not only is it a non-standard written form, but in many cases with texting, we wouldn't even know how to speak it.
Mm-hmm. Right. It doesn't even matter because it has its own conventions. And that's something that you see with vernacular literature, that a reader can delve into it and develop the vocabulary very easily. Everyone performs to some degree. Vernacular isn't necessarily an outpouring of unadorned feeling, but that it's always a performance, that there's always an audience. And sometimes the audience is an audience of outsiders. So we have to understand that there's a way in which vernacular language comes to be a performance of ethnicity. Yet it still does also have that function of overcoming the alienation of standard English. So it's both at the same time. It doesn't want to allow you to just throw out standard English and say, okay, this is fake and this is real. It's much more complex than that.
Yeah, I'm thinking again actually of punk, because all of the authenticity of punk was chiseled,
mm-hmm.
very, very chiseled. And so although there was great fear among the likes of Joe Strummer that they might sell out, nonetheless, he went by the name Joe Strummer, which was not the name he was given. So I guess they were dealing with similar sort of questions of authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you look at something like that and you just think that this is life as it is real and all other literature is mm-hmm. some kind of construct.
Exactly.
But that's not the case.
But the category of the real is a marketing category in itself. And I think the reason that I don't feel nervous about people missing that point is that the selections in this collection are so alive to that irony. And they're so careful about coding the moments of performance into the work itself.
Okay, time for an example. Here's Janice Lawrence Clark performing a poem by Jamaican writer Louise Bennett.
Katie, my child, you missing ting? You should have come with me. Band concert up at Oak, my dear. You want to see what we see? Music they'll play upon bandstand. And picnic they'll play upon grass. Motor car lay down like rotten mango down a Gombe pass.
Wow, that makes all the difference, listening to it rather than reading it. Okay, we'll return to my interview with Rotten English editor Dora Ahmad after we hear one more poem. This one from Jamaican dub poet Muta Baraka.
This poem shall speak of the wretched sea that washed ships to these shores, of mothers crying for their young swallowed up by the sea. This poem shall say nothing new. This poem shall speak of time, time unlimited, time undefined. This poem shall call names, names like Lumumba, Kenyatta, Nkrumah, Hannibal, Atherton, Malcolm, Garvey, Haile Selassie. This poem is vexed about apartheid, racism, fascism, the Ku Klux Klan, riots in Brixton, Atlanta, Jim Jones. This poem is revolting against first world, second world, third world, division, man-made decision. This poem is like all the rest. This poem will not be amongst great literary works, will not be recited by poetry enthusiasts. It will not be quoted by politicians nor men of religion. This poem is knives, bombs, guns, blood, fire, blazing for freedom. Yes.
There's so much going on here that's just absolutely essential to vernacular literature. It deals with the irony of canonicity. It says this poem will not be amongst great literary works, and yet here it is in all of these anthologies. And Mutabaruka will go on stage and read it out, knowing that it doesn't have the same meaning that it did when he first wrote it. It has this kind of aura of canonicity now. My students, I assigned this poem, and my students found it on YouTube and brought it into class. And I remember a student saying that he was shocked that Mutabaruka was reading it out because it did feel so oral. So that was a great example for me of the fact that, no, it is, it's crafted. It's supposed to, it's manipulated to have this kind of flow.
This poem is no secret. This poem shall be called boring, stupid, senseless. This poem is watching you trying to make sense from this poem. This poem is messing up your brains, making you want to stop listening to this poem. But you shall not stop listening to this poem. You need to know what will be said next in this poem. This poem shall disappoint you because this poem is to be continued in your mind.
Jamaican dub poet Mutabaruka's This Poem. I asked Dora Ahmad about the anger that drives so much rotten English. She said it's all about history.
In many cases, it's the history of the violent erasure of an original language. There's often a physical penalty to speaking one's own language. So the literature responds to that. Kamal Brathwaite writes about what he calls nation language being like a machine gun. So there is a kind of violent response to the violence that's already been done.
A real love-hate relationship mm-hmm. with the English language.
Mm-hmm. Norbus E. Philip calls it the anguish that is English, really tying those words together. So yeah, absolutely. It's the weapon that they have. It's what they're going to use. They're absolutely committed to turning it around and using it to represent their own experience. But they understand that that legacy of loss is contained within every sentence.
Where do you see the future of rotten English going? I mean, as you say, as soon as somebody establishes certain phrases mm-hmm. or even a style, it's in peril of becoming mainstream mm-hmm. and so, quote, less authentic. Does that mean that we're going to see more of this type of language on paper?
I think that's a possibility. I mean, I think there's always been a lot. We just haven't necessarily recognized it as such. But yeah, there's certainly been more in the last, say, 10, 15, 20 years. I think there are two forces happening at the same time. On the one hand, it is becoming more mainstream on the literary level. On the other hand, that's a bit hypocritical because there are still these power dynamics that dictate that standard English is going to be absolutely necessary for anyone with the desire for economic mobility. So I think there's a certain kind of literary and cultural cachet that isn't really backed up in reality. So I don't think we're going to get into a situation where there is no standard English. I think standard English is always going to be a factor. It's something that I have to talk about with my students, for example, because we're spending all of this time in class reading people who break all of the rules that they're learning in their other classes. So they come into my class and they feel like, okay, now I can get away with anything, but I still have the responsibility to make sure that they graduate and are going to be able to put their CV together and get a job. And that's something that absolutely hasn't changed and won't change.
That's really interesting. So do you, when you assign them mm-hmm. to write about rotten English, do they have to write in standard English?
They do. They do have to write in standard English because I do feel that I have the responsibility of making sure that they graduate with these skills. Otherwise, I will be crippling them. So yeah, it's a very delicate balance as a teacher to empower what pedagogues call students' home language without limiting them to that home language if it's one that is not going to help them in these mainstream situations. And it also, there are a lot of obstacles to dealing within the classroom. And one of them is the fact that students are really wary and students are embarrassed to read it out loud. And often teachers are embarrassed to read it out loud. But I do feel like there's something really productive about that sort of discomfort. So that's something that I'm always happy to have going on in my classroom, because then we can talk about where that discomfort comes from and what kind of lag there is between the oral form and the written form. What sorts of pressures are on you as a reader what expectations you have to conform to, where racial identity plays into some of this writing.
So you will get a student who is, I don't know, you'll get a Dominican American student to read some Scottish rotten English.
Yeah, one thing I'm always really careful to do in my class is not to pigeonhole students and say, okay, you read this out loud because this is yours. And I also just find it wonderful. I make all of my students do at least one exercise of vernacular writing. And I really avoid the concept of home language, in fact. I don't want to limit students to what I might presume is the code that they're more comfortable with. So, for example, I had a student who's from Trinidad write her vernacular exercise in Black Baltimore, which I assume she probably knows through the wire. So this is somebody who decided that she could have taken the easy way out. She could have written in Trinidadian English, and she wanted to do the experiment along with everybody else.
How did it work out?
Oh, it was fantastic. I feel like they can't understand these products nearly as well unless they try creating them themselves. So I do leave a lot of room for creative pieces. When they're doing analytical work, they do need to write in standard English for me. And that, to some degree, is reproducing that same kind of hypocritical divide that I talked about earlier. Okay, this is fine if you're being creative and artistic, but when you get down to it and you get serious, then you have to perform in standard English. But again, I think it's something that all of these authors are very aware of. So often in these stories, there's a moment where the author reminds us that, in fact, we wouldn't be experiencing all of this. We wouldn't have access to any of this if the author herself or himself wasn't able to code switch and didn't have access to publicity and publication and media in standard English. So they're very canny about that as well. I think as readers, we can tend to romanticize vernacular expression, whereas the authors are careful not to romanticize it. They want us to know this is one form among many. I myself am not limited to it. Nobody should be limited to any one form, whether it's a standard or a non-standard form. But I'm letting you know that this is how it works.
Dora Ahmad, editor of the literary anthology Rotten English. It's available in paperback. Get a copy. It's great. Okay, that's it for this week. As far as eating sideways is concerned, well, we've been slopping it down horizontally throughout today's podcast. But here's a word to chew on. The word is hooligan. It's Danish. It's a newish word. And it plays off the English word hooligan. Hooligan. Hooli means peaceful. So hooligan means peaceful or non-violent soccer fan. We're done. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye now.